Okay, and thank you everybody for joining us. As you're now all aware, today is the last of 7 days of Triad that have been hosted by EPA and the Triad Community of Practice, or the Triad COP, which we'll put a quick plug in for at the end of the call. Today's session is specifically on dynamic work strategies, one of the three legs of the Triad approach. And today's two presentations, purposely, in terms of how we selected them, they build upon each other and make for a wonderful hour in terms of the critical aspect of Triad implementation. The first presentation is an overview of the concepts and benefits of implementing a dynamic work strategy with a focus on utilizing 3D visualization tools as an evolving tool that project stakeholders can use to make decisions and manage data real time. And then the second presentation, we're going to build on those same concepts but offer kind of a unique perspective in terms of discussing data management techniques that can be used for multi-site, multi-year programs with large data sets. So without further ado, today's first speaker is Mr. John Soule from Columbia Technologies. John is co-founder and CEO of Columbia Technologies, where he directs the development of innovative business solutions fusing technology and geochemistry in the growing field of informatics. So John, hopefully everybody's got smart as slide number one, and John, we look to you to make us smarter.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Gene, and welcome to everyone to the seventh and final day of Triad in August. I'm going to talk about some concepts this morning, fairly simple concepts to understand, more difficult to implement when you think about the dynamics of all the people that are involved in a Triad process. But it really is going to focus on what tools do we have and the importance of using those tools day by day or even hour by hour as the Triad process goes along. The entering argument or understanding or philosophy is that your team, and by team I mean the technical folks, the consulting engineers and scientists that are involved, the regulatory agencies, the people paying the bills, all subscribe to the idea that they need to communicate the information together, they need to work together to make the decisions. Oftentimes all of us run into the scenario of, I don't want to look at the information until you've thoroughly scrubbed it, written your report, and deliver it to me. That historical paradigm doesn't really work in managing the data gaps in an economic fashion. So we're going to talk about this from what we call a real-time perspective. So shift to slide two. I'm going to speak to the term economics. It's all about the money, whether we want to admit it or not. The technical strategy or technical confidence is key, but it really is about what is it going to take to restore my piece of real estate back to a viable functionality, whether that be for the country, for the buyer, for the state, whatever. And so the questions we're always dealing with is, you know, just how good is the characterization I've got on my site? Tools have evolved over the last couple of decades, and what type of characterizations that we can do. And oftentimes characterization that's 10 years old is not the characterization that leads to the best remedial strategy today. So just how good is the characterization is the question we're always dealing with, whether we're in the cleanup business, you know, the technology employment business or whatever. What's the best strategy for cleanup, remediation, returning to this piece of property to a viable alternative? How do we price our effort? How well am I spending my clients' money? So therefore I'm going to get some repeat business out of this and come up with a new one we're seeing much more of today, and appropriately, is just how sustainable is the approach I'm taking to my project, and how do we measure success when we tackle these projects. So these are many of the elements that affect the economics as well as the technical result and the political result and the sociological result of what we're doing out there. Shifting to slide three, we've learned from earlier in the presentations in August from Robert Howe with Petrotech that there are several factors that affect the clarity of the CSM, conceptual site model. And it's the CSM forms the critical basis of all the decision making that goes on in the triad process. So just exactly what is the clarity of the CSM is a function of, you know, how do we present it? We may have a clear understanding in our mind, but if we don't have a way of presenting that information to the team or to the stakeholders, we're going to have a tough time dealing with the decisions that go into it. Just how much data was available for the CSM? What type of data do we have? How much is available? What other data do we need? And I like to kind of turn that in from data to think about it in terms of information. Where's the piece of property going? What's the intended reuse? What are the various past experiences and expectations that the various stakeholders have in the property? That can frame how they think the site should be approached, or it can frame, the decision-making process for the other in working with the other stakeholders. And again, that last item, economics and time constraints. Oftentimes we're working to a very artificial set of deadlines which put in a whole bunch of artificial costs. So these are things that Robert covered earlier in an earlier session. Shifting to slide four, Tom Belaya with CH2M Hill spoke to some tools that are pretty common in each of the triad projects that you'll find case studies on the Clue-In site. Three primary tools. Everything needs to be in a geospatial. We need to know where it is on the earth, you know, how do the data sets come together, how do we compile and visualize collaborative data sets. That in and of itself is not an insignificant issue when working with various sources of data, various sources of geographical or geospatial information. A three-dimensional visualization system and animation, while you need to use these very carefully, they do provide a very high-definition look at how to visualize what's going on the site, and it forms a wonderful communication tool for the stakeholders, for the folks involved in the triad team and the decision-making process. And then the final item is, what elements do we need, what multi-criteria decision support tools, what elements do we need to consider when we make the technical decision? One particular stakeholder may be concerned about, you know, the groundwater transport. Somebody else may be concerned about the soil contamination. Somebody else may be concerned about the vapor intrusion. And that will lead to what data needs to be collected and what goes into the decision support system in order to make those decisions. So these are things that we've heard earlier in August. They form the basis of the triad process. Shifting to slide five. Slowly but surely. What we particularly at Columbia Technologies bring to the triad process that we've been using now for about 10 years is taking the concept of these tool sets that Tom Playa talked to and the clarity that Robert Howe talked to and bring it to a very short cycle time. In other words, how do we collect field data, get it to the decision makers in an understandable format, and allow decisions to be made in a very short period of time, or what we would call real time. The current package of three technologies are high-resolution sensors, which can be a number of different types of sensors. Cone penetrometers have been with us for decades. We have membrane interface probes that have been around for just under a couple of decades, laser-induced fluorescence for a couple of decades, hydraulic profiling tools, or anything that gives us a high data rate or a high definition rate in terms of managing the data source or data uncertainty. using direct sensing type of sensors, we get a digital stream of data that can then be moved literally anywhere in the world, allow us to then go to advanced analytics, and perform some visualization data sets, use those tool sets, geospatial data sets that Tom talked about, in a real-time fashion, and then the wonderful internet allows us to put it back out to the technical team for digestion, decision-making, and data gap identification and closing in essentially real-time, and allows you to do that literally on a global basis. So three components. Sensors are high data rate sources of information. Could be XRF, could be rapid mobile lab analysis, it could be direct sensing tools, things that where we're trying to cover a lot of geospatial territory quickly, map that out with analytical tools, geospatial tools, visualize it, deliver it back to the technical team, and make decisions. So the ideal triad conference team call, in our opinion, has, in our experience, has all the parties on site, on the phone call, looking at the same information in literally real time and making decisions about where do we need to go next. Not every day, not every hour, but at appropriate times in the decision points of the work plan that was created in the triad process. Move to slide 6. So let's go back to the economics. What's the value proposition? Why do we care about real time? Hey, the report's not due for a month. What exactly, why do we want to consider the value proposition of something, what we would call real time? Well, let's tackle the sensor question. High resolution. EPA, agencies, federal agencies, state agencies, and all of our experience all teach us that the greatest source of error that we have in the work that we do out there, and the risk of failure, poor remedial performance, and the loss of capital, money in the site, is the site characterization and data gaps that exist in the characterization. Mother Nature is extremely homogeneous. The chemical, geochemical distributions are extremely, heterogeneous, and therefore the issue of periodic or episodic or time late information in samples is going to lead to a source of error. Now, there's always going to be some error. The question is what is the acceptable rate of error, level of error for the amount of work or the use or the other elements of the triad package? So we look at high resolution tools as our primary source of data. And just a couple of simple examples. We'll use a three-dimensional picture here, and I ask the question, can you afford to miss? And here's a routine, regular type of scenario where early on the work plan definitions in decades ago were, okay, someone treats the soil or the bedo zone type of information, somebody else deals with the groundwater problem. Somebody goes in and does the traditional, sampling, monitoring wells, and budget expenditures, go to the traditional soil vapor extraction, let's get the stuff out of the soil, and oh, by the way, we know we've got a couple of nice layered confining units here that are holding back the material. But if you go in and look at that at high resolution and look in both the vedo zone, the vapors, the soil, and the groundwater distribution, you'll find, well, in fact, we've got a pretty significant residual petroleum that's migrating across the site. And so, therefore, we've got kind of the issue that's got to be dealt with before it gets off the property boundary, contaminates the drinking water well, or whatever. So traditional approaches or historical methods, I think we're all evolving off of these over time, but oftentimes much of the budget and much of the effort that goes into the sites have been constricted by the work plan discussion, but also by the data that was collected on the site based on a historical paradigm. So how can we get in and look at lots of data vertically and horizontally that's adequate enough in order to make decisions about where to actually spend the economics and the budget and the hardware? Okay. Shifting to slide 9. That leads to the question we're always dealing with, just exactly where do we want to sample, how do we sample, how many samples do we need to take, and going in not considering that from a soil contamination, groundwater contamination, migration, reuse, vapor, all those elements that are in our decision matrix. We can't go in and just let's just go in with a limited investigation based on budget constraints and guess where we're going to take the data. You might as well just kind of not really go at it. So it's expensive to guess on where we're going to take the samples. So shifting to slide 10, what the triad process teaches us to do is to take fairly low economic cost tools and collect lots of data sets so we're not missing the components. They may have a certain degree of error to them for whatever reasons and depending on what tool you're using, but the idea is to get a lot of geospatial area covered very quickly to make sure we're not missing information and then focus in on the more rigid or even more expensive types of sampling and analysis. So here's an example of one high-resolution sensor data. You take something like laser-induced fluorescence. It's going to give you a high resolution. In this terms, it's going to be 20 times a foot. So we're going to be in a 20-foot borehole. You're going to get 400 pieces of data. You're going to get multiple wavelengths or spectroscopy of the information. So you're going to see what types of petroleum products we have in the. It's going to go through both the beta zone and through the groundwater interface and then into the groundwaters. We're going to get chemical compound information. We're going to get stratigraphic information. We're going to minimize the vertical data gaps, and we're going to be able to see that in real time. We're going to get a digital output, which then can be captured, pushed through those analytic systems that we talked about, and communicated back out to the technical team, literally globally, literally in near real time. So that's the type of information that allows us to really implement the triad process in a dynamic work strategy, hour by hour on sites. Look to slide 11. So we talked about the economic impact of high resolution. Talk about speed, second sort of value proposition. Why speed? And the key here is identifying and closing data gaps with little or no additional cost in real time. The repeat mobilization to go back and redefine the surprise that came in the laboratory analysis of the few samples that we took on a site identifies or creates data gaps that all of us have to deal with our clients, with the regulatory agencies, and the technical team, the triad technical team that's trying to manage the data uncertainty is working what we would call time late on information and hence increases the amount of rework, the amount of cost, and the chance of failure, technical failure, because the information, the data gaps were identified behind the flow of the work project. So speed, real-time information allows us to say, hey, we've got a whiff or a sniff or a hit over in this location, let's bound the uncertainty around that using these low-cost economic high data rate tools and allow us to go in and tackle that. So the second value proposition really is speed. Okay, slide 12. Talked about it. Again, Tom Pelaya mentioned it. Robert Howe mentioned it. Communication. It's very difficult to discuss the problem and make a decision if we don't all understand what we're working with. So once we look at stuff in a three-dimensional visualization system based on a geospatial placement of the data, it turns into information and people can start to understand it. All of the stakeholders, both technical and non-technical, wherever they are located, on the globe can start to be involved in the communication process and you can speed up what happens in the decision-making process. And if all of us think of examples of what the internet did to various industries once you put the information online, look at what it did to the travel industry, what we're trying to do with the healthcare industry, but the ability to basically put information and decision-making information at the fingertips and the desktops of the stakeholders allows the whole process to go much more cost effectively and actually much less expensively. So third value proposition is communication. slide 13, cost alternatives. So let's say we don't use an approach that collects high resolution, moves it very quickly, and creates the data gaps or the uncertainty that's been documented by case study after case study. What's going to happen? Well, it's going to cost us more when we decide where to sample. It's going to cost us more where we put the monitoring wells. It's going to cost us more where we decide on the remedial implementation, which may or may not be the right remedial implementation. It's going to cost us more to go do additional characterization when that doesn't work. And then we have this rework or technical failure. So there are significant cost alternatives to doing the small incremental cost of high-resolution characterization in real time. So using a triad approach may have a little more upfront investment on the part of you and your clients, but the downside is if you don't get it right up front, the cost alternatives of getting it wrong downstream in the whole life cycle of the project. Same thing from when you start thinking about that from a sustainability approach, but we're not going to talk about that much today. Slide 14, cost of error. A lot of the difficulties that you run into when you get out into Mother Nature is how do we deal with complex geologies? Where can we sample? Where can't we sample? Where can we get, that could be driven by the stratigraphy of the site, could be done by the depth of the information, it could be done because the information's offshore, it can be done because the information's in bedrock. What tools do we have to go get those samples, whether it be soil, groundwater, or vapor samples? How do we get them? Are they representative of where the data should be collected? And can we, in fact, get those in a heaving sand or a difficult caliche layer or something of that sort? So there are sources of error in the sampling process that have to be dealt with, and again, that oftentimes limits the amount of data that we collect and then therefore increases the uncertainty. Shifting to slide 15, simple concept that Triad again teaches us. It's the inverted data prime pyramid, and it's also the same thing that we hear when we discuss data quality objectives. What can we get in terms of lots of low-cost, reliable enough information to make sure we don't miss a problem, adequately bound it, determine the property boundaries, determine the vertical and horizontal extents? How do we then target where we need to go in for confirmation, what I would call confirmation information, get the lab analysis, get the actual mass calculations, get a second read on what exactly compounds we're looking at there, and then therefore go in and place the critical monitoring wells and other data vapor wells that we need in order to sustain the long-term approach on the site. Where we often get off track is where we go in and start taking the confirmation data based, and it turns out to be limited because that's the historical or paradigm that we work with, and we miss the low-cost data approach up front, and then therefore miss a lot of what's going on the site. Slide 16, let's just do a simple example of how that works and think about the tax dollar that you pay at the gas pump to run the underground storage tank reimbursement funds. Here's a simple example that sort of personifies or gives us an idea of how all this works. Here's a simple UST site. I asked the question, what's wrong with this picture? In this case, the UST fund has authorized a couple 3 days of work using a membrane interface probe to go look for dissolved petroleum concentrations around a former UST site. And there's a total of, it looks like, about 14 membrane interface probes down to 60, 70 feet at this particular location. And you can see quickly where the bad tumor is, if you want to call it that. It communicates quickly to your stakeholders. But if we go to slide 17, what's going on in this slide from an economic perspective? What we see is 80% of the budget, 80% of the data, and 80% of the information has been collected over here on the left-hand side, left three-quarters of the site, based on a very constrained work plan essentially proscribed by the agency and the clients involved in this. Yet, with only 2 out of the 14 boreholes indicating a problem, we've got most of the uncertainty now to the right, and actually the north and the south of this particular site, that's unbounded. We've done a nice job bounding it to the left, more than a nice job, and we've extended way too much of the budget. If this information is looked at in an hour by hour or real time, or in what Triad defines as soon enough framework, then, and it's matched up with a dynamic work plan through the systematic planning process, that decisions could have been made, or the team could have been sent out to say, well, once you get this information, if you get negative results, move or change or focus on bounding the uncertainty to the right side of this particular project. So that's just a very typical example where we spend 80% of the budget putting in prescribed work plans that don't deal with the dynamics of what goes on the site. Okay, slide 18, just kind of summarizing a couple of things. So what does Triad do in terms of SMART? It basically attacks, where the dynamic work strategies do, is attack the data gap question and lower the risk, speeds up the decision-making process so we're not wondering where is the problem, did we get it bounded or not. That enables us to use our resources, whether they be field resources, team resources, hardware, material, people, capital, more effectively on the site, and then also, obviously, with that, we're going to get more cleanups on target, as we could say. Slide 19. So what's the reduced return on your Triad investment? If you and the technical team engage in it, you're going to, again, look at this from an economics, reduce the number of mobilizations and the amount of data collection that goes on, reduce the impact of collecting incorrect or inadequate data, so that on the downstream work planning remedial alternatives, not put the wrong, take too many samples or too few samples and put them in the wrong place, same thing for monitoring wells, and again, not going to go out there and start targeting remedial hardware and approaches or injection processes without having a better target. Simple case example, going to put in large, expensive, dual-case, deep monitoring wells. The question is, where are you going to put them and where are you going to screen the intervals so that you're going to monitor an evolving plume that's going to change over time? Something like a direct sensing tool may well place that very expensive screen for a fraction of the cost. So, it's what's the cost up front versus the investment return downstream. Okay, shifting to the last slides, just to wrap up contact information for me, so if you need follow-on information on the things that we discussed. And with that, Nick, I'll turn it back over to you. And I wasn't able to track on any questions that came up, but I'm certainly available for those when the times are appropriate.
And that time is now. There wasn't any questions that came online during, but I encourage everybody, for those on the phone lines, if you want, you can hit #6 to unmute your line and ask John a question now. Those streaming in, you can use the question button, and it refreshes very quickly. So we'll see if anybody has any questions for John with regards to his presentation. And with that, there'll be another opportunity at the end. So if a question comes up or you think of something while Regina is speaking, there'll be another opportunity at the end of this to ask the questions real time. Otherwise, again, there'll be the opportunity to contact the speakers directly. So that, moving onward, I'm going to direct everybody to slide 21 and introduce our second presenter is Ms. Regina Dixon Butler from the United States Air Force. Regina is an environmental engineer that has provided technical support to the environmental cleanup program at Cape Canaveral and Patrick Air Force Base for over 10 years. And of course, we all know Cape Canaveral is in the news, even as we speak today. Regina was recently hired by the Air Force as project manager and continues to put her experience to work in the cleanup office at Cape Canaveral and Patrick Air Force Base. And it's the extensive work at these two restoration programs that will be discussed here today, basically taking a lot of the concepts and benefits that that John articulated, and providing a very real life case study. So with that, Regina, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Nick. Hi, I'm going to discuss today how we've tried to take the concepts of Triad, the dynamic work strategies, the systematic planning, and the real-time data management and analysis, and apply them more at a programmatic level. I mean, of course, there's a lot of benefit, as John just discussed, to applying those principles at a project level, and I think that that's the way that we normally kind of think of Triad. But in a program like we have at Cape and Patrick, where there are a large number of sites, some of them are high profile, some of them have very high dollar and long-term projects, and we have a lot of significant long-term management concerns, we found that trying to integrate those principles at a programmatic level that sort of overarches and encompasses all of our projects has really been a key to our success. So first of all, on the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit just about the overall conceptual applicability of Triad to program management, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about Cape and Patrick as a kind of case study for how we've done it here. I'll go over a little bit of the history and setting at both of the bases, talk about some of the challenges that we faced here, and discuss the tools and strategies that we've developed to help us overcome those challenges. Next slide. I'm going to get into the conceptual applicability now, and if you'll move to slide 24. Through past experience, we found that a real regimented and inflexible approach to management has hampered our investigation and cleanup process at individual sites, and then that has in turn ultimately slowed the overall progress of our program. And so years ago, before Triad even really had a name, we found ourselves kind of applying those core principles, again, dynamic work strategies, systematic planning, and real-time data management, to the program as a whole. And this helped us streamline the entire restoration process from cradle to grave, and sort of helped us establish that overall overarching framework, which then in turn facilitated Triad at a more site-specific and project level. And we feel that by ingraining these concepts at a program level, we've provided better assurance for the overall long-term success of our program. Next slide. So a quick review of our Triad pillars and how they translate into a program management paradigm. We've identified several kind of key concepts that we feel are central to ingraining Triad at a programmatic level. These include increasing and ensuring active stakeholder involvement, trying to work together to establish common goals and ensure that we share our constraints with one another. Working to facilitate information and data exchange, making sure that, you know, that information is readily accessible to all of our stakeholders. Document, document, document. Documenting our approaches as well as documenting our past decisions. And then being able to look at those approaches and decisions to help streamline future decisions and to just help streamline our overall management process. And finally, at the same time, we're always looking ahead for how we can optimize in the long term and improve our program. Slide 26. So how do we ingrain Triad in program management? First of all, we try to focus on the outcome, not just a regimented process that we're going to follow lockstep. And of course, that's kind of one of the fundamentals of Triad. We found it's very important to establish consistency in our process, but it's equally important to ingrain flexibility into that process so you can deviate where it makes sense to deviate. we tried to establish both consistency and innovation. And I know that kind of on the face of it, those two things may seem kind of like polar opposites, but I kind of think of them as two sides of the same coin. We're always looking for ways that we can innovate in how we manage our program, but at the same time, as we discover changes that we can integrate to make things better, we need to document those changes, we need to document why they're making them, and then we need to try to apply them consistently across our whole program, across all of our sites and all of our projects, so that, you know, everything from the top down can benefit from those innovations. And finally, stakeholder involvement has been key in helping us to work as a team, not as adversaries. And formal partnering has really been kind of the underpinning of all of this. We have a formal partnering relationship with our regulators and with our other stakeholders, and that has really helped us to all work together to move the program forward effectively. So next, I'm going to move more into the case study and talk about some of the specifics at Cape Canaveral and Patrick. So if you'll move ahead to slide 28, quick overview of our program here. I work for the 45th Space Wing, which includes Patrick Air Force Base, Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, and a number of downrange facilities. Overall, we manage 320 different solid waste management units, which is a regulatory term, which encompass 165 different environmental restoration sites, some of them which include multiple solid waste management units. In the past, from 1991 to 2007, we spent $169 million on investigation and cleanup, and we still have a lot of remaining requirements out there, about $135 million additional between 2008 and 2040. As you can see from the pie chart, we have successfully moved a lot of our solid waste management units into no further action status, but we do have a number of sites which continue kind of in the tail of the program with system operations, monitoring, and long-term controls. And then we've got a handful of sites where we're still investigating and doing active cleanup. We are considered the world's premier gateway to space, but that legacy of, you know, a lot of space launches has left us with some environmental contamination. Most notably, chlorinated solvents in groundwater are a big issue for us. Slide 30 provides you with a quick kind of bird's eye view of Cape Canaveral. Just for reference, we are located on a barrier island, and there are a lot of threatened and endangered species and a lot of sensitive habitat. So those things play a major factor in all of our cleanup decisions here. Current and former space launch complexes kind of march up and down the Atlantic coast on the Cape. We have other industrial and support operations in the interior of the base, and then to the west, we're bounded by the Banana River Lagoon. And you can see in the lower right of this slide, our solid waste management units are shown in red, and our groundwater plumes have a kind of greenish-blue outline. On the next slide, Patrick Air Force Base is more of what you might think of as a typical military base. You know, of course, there are industrial areas, but there's also housing on the base. There are recreational facilities, a golf course, etc. Again, in the lower right, there's a snapshot of our solid waste management and groundwater plumes. We have a lot less acreage at Patrick that's impacted with environmental concerns, and the areas that you see that are kind of large are things like very old landfills that we have to keep an eye on, but, you know, don't necessarily cause a lot of major cleanup issues for us at present. Next slide, slide 32. So we've had our share of issues with soil that we've dealt with, but far and away, contaminated groundwater has been our biggest cleanup challenge. The past use of chlorinated solvents created a number of sites with both dense non-aqueous phase liquid as well as high concentration dissolved solvents in the subsurface. Between 2003 and 2008, We implemented 7 major cleanup actions that totaled around $36 million, and we've still got a couple sites where we have actions pending. We're lucky that the barrier island environment yields less than optimal groundwater quality, so nobody's currently drinking our groundwater. However, because it's considered a potential drinking water resource, we do have to clean up to drinking water standards. Next slide. So now you've kind of got a flavor for our program. I'd like to move forward and review some of the major challenges that we faced, which application of the triad principles have helped us overcome and address. And I'll come back to these challenges later in the briefing and kind of tie everything together. First of all, it's always challenging to try to make sure that we integrate our cleanup projects with mission requirements and return facilities for, you know, active reuse in a time frame and in a manner that will meet mission needs. Second of all, lengthy review and coordination in the past has sometimes slowed down our process and, you know, got us off schedule in terms of some of our plans. Changing stakeholders and evolving regulatory processes are always a big challenge. And goals and expectations, trying to align our stakeholders' goals and set realistic expectations is something that we struggle with on a daily basis. Process inconsistencies are a big problem and can cause confusion among the stakeholders and can, you know, create some of those unrealistic expectations or misaligned goals. Remedy selection, formalization, and implementation was a big problem for us in the past when we were just kind of getting over the hump on some of these major remediation projects, just trying to figure out how to implement those and how to go about doing things was a big challenge. And finally, again, long-term planning is just something that we always have to look towards so that we can continue to be effective in the future. And so now I want to talk a little bit about some of the tools and the strategies that we've developed to help us address and overcome these challenges. On slide 34, I have a graphic that outlines some of our stakeholders, and we found that encouraging active and engaged stakeholder involvement, I mean, is really one of the single biggest factors that has helped us succeed. Our program has 5 major stakeholder categories that are shown here on this graphic. They all play a role in decision-making, and each in their own way can either kind of derail the process or can help us move forward. These include our general public, our regulatory community, our local and Air Force and DOD management personnel, our support contractors who help us actually implement our investigation and cleanup projects, and then other folks here on the base who, you know, have their own missions and responsibilities but who may be impacted by our cleanup activities or who may want to reuse some of our sites. So at the working level, myself and my counterparts here all participate in formal partnering. We're all part of a Tier 1 partnering team. We sit on the team with our counterparts at the regulatory agencies, with the representatives of our major contractors, and, you know, with the folks at some of our service agencies who help us contract things. Through partnering, decision-making has been delegated to our level, and our management counterparts participate in a Tier 2, a higher-level partnering team. And for the most part, they let us go about our business and work together and do our jobs, but they do help us out when we have programmatic issues, things that might cut across, you know, multiple bases in the state or multiple regulatory jurisdictions. And they've helped us, you know, get past some challenging issues on those fronts. And we certainly had our share of conflicts and problems within the team, but the formal partnering environment has really helped foster an attitude of cooperation at the working level among all of our kind of grassroots stakeholders. Now, it's also, we found, equally important to ensure that we have effective outreach with other folks, the non-environmental folks here on the installation who are just kind of trying to go about their mission-related jobs. We really need to try to integrate with those folks, and we found that pretty simple things. Things like maybe accelerating or delaying a project slightly can make all the difference in the world from a mission perspective. And in some cases, taking a modified approach to implementation. A simple fix, like using a vacuum truck instead of an excavator for a soil removal, can help get those folks on board, can address concerns that they may have, and can help us move forward. We really try to work proactively with the non-environmental folks on the base rather than reactively. We want to get them involved up front. We want to address their concerns in the planning process, and then hopefully we can move forward without a hitch when we're in the field. Next slide, 36. Management, I've already talked about a little bit. They're engaged in our process through Tier 2 partnering. They pretty much trust us to do our jobs and to go about our business, but when we need them to help us advocate for funding or to establish high-level policy, they're there to help us out. Our Restoration Advisory Board consists of members of the general public who meet quarterly to hear about our program and provide feedback to us, and we have a very positive relationship with them. However, our relationship with the public has not always been quite so positive. In the mid-1990s, we had some community relations issues with a cancer cluster south of Patrick Air Force Base, and those issues were eventually resolved through a lot of hard work and the contributions of various Air Force and regulatory entities, but we don't want to go back to having an adversarial relationship with the community. I mean, that's something that I think we've all decided we really don't want to revisit again. So we work real hard to keep the RAB actively involved, to be open and honest and upfront with them about everything. And I think, you know, that's come back to help us because they help advocate for us both within the community and with our own management. And they help provide a sounding board for new ideas. And they're also very strong advocates for crossfeed. They love it when they hear that we're doing things like this, that we're kind of getting out there and sharing some of our successes and challenges with the industry. And they really encourage that. So, stakeholders are very important, but it's also important that we keep them engaged in the program. So how do we do that? Well, we've developed a number of different tools that we use to kind of get them the information they need and to keep them involved and to let them know what we're doing. So now I'm going to talk about a couple of those tools. First of all, we have a series of what we call our programmatic documents. These documents provide overall direction and continuity for the program. They outline consistent approaches for how we're going to do things and why we're going to do them. They help establish our lines of communications among the stakeholders. They provide mechanisms for problem solving. They also discuss the common goals of all the stakeholders and how we're all going to come together to achieve those. And additionally, these documents help eliminate things that might otherwise be redundant at the site or project level. They help us streamline those site or project level type planning documents. Our programmatic documents include a decision process document that outlines the decision process for each phase of work, the field sampling procedures, which provide guidelines for how we're going to conduct our field activities, quality assurance program plan, which provides our policy on analytical methods and processes, a land use management plan, which establishes the framework and details of our land use control program, and we've also got operating procedures for both bases so that when our contractors come onto the base, they know what's expected in terms of badging and security, safety, waste management, all those kinds of things. It really helps eliminate confusion. Next slide, 38. We've also developed a number of standardized templates for various documents that we have to produce for site after site or project after project. We found that developing these templates for displaying the same type of information from project to project and contractor to contractor, when you use a template, it keeps the stakeholders on track. It helps them to know where to find what they're looking for when they're looking for it. When they get a report, they know how the figures and tables are going to look. when they get a fact sheet, they know exactly how the information is going to be laid out. I think one great example of standardization and how it's made things more consistent is our corrective action management plan. This is a document which outlines all of our regulatory deliverables for every site and every phase of work, current and future. One of our project managers used to dread all of the meetings because he was in charge of maintaining this corrective action management plan. And it was a nightmare. Every month he had to go through it and look and try to update all the dates and try to reformat it and, you know, get it in a form that would be presentable to our team. So we finally looked at, I mean, how can we do this better? How can we do this more efficiently? And we ended up putting all of that information into a database. Now, of course, somebody still has to maintain the database. It doesn't, unfortunately, maintain itself. But we've managed to automate a lot of those update processes. And we've managed to standardize the formatting. So now we can go in, change some of those dates where needed, push a button, and the report's going to print out. It's always going to look the same. It's always going to be consistent. And I think that our other project manager who had those problems with that was very glad to give that up and to see that happen. So now moving on to slide 39, our electronic data. We've worked very hard to get all of our program documentation indexed, organized, and where appropriate, scanned. And we've built a web-based interface to make all of our documents and correspondence easily accessible to all of our stakeholders. Our electronic archive, shown here on this slide, is publicly accessible. We've got a couple screenshots here, and you're welcome to try to access it yourself through the link on the bottom of the screen there at your leisure. We have cross-referenced all of our documents and correspondence extensively with one another and by Solid Waste Management Unit. We've built several different search functions on this website that help our stakeholders access this information. And we've gotten a lot of positive feedback from all the stakeholders on this site. And I know that, you know, a lot of people go in here on a daily basis and download documents and use it for document review. Our next slide is a kind of extension of our electronic archive. We also have a desktop database tool. We kind of affectionately refer to this tool as CRITR because we call it our Comprehensive Restoration Information Tracking Electronic Repository. It's a Microsoft Access-based tool, so it's not super high-tech or complicated, but we custom designed it in our office to basically specifically address our needs. And it's pretty much one-stop shopping for all of our site-related data. We've kind of managed to cross-reference and incorporate everything in the kitchen sink into this database, including, you know, any kind of status information about any of our solid waste management units, any of our meeting minutes or decisions, information about all the phases of work at every site, past, present, and future, which includes our regulatory corrective action management plan that I discussed a few minutes ago, site status information, monitoring program details, land use control information, the list kind of goes on and on. And I think that having that information kind of available at the touch of a button at our fingertips really helps us build credibility with our stakeholders. When someone sitting at the table has a question about why we did something or how we did it, and we can immediately go into the database and maybe find a decision from 5 years ago, you know, that provides the justification that we need, you know, when we can come up with that in an instant, that's a big credibility builder and a big confidence builder. Next slide, I just have a couple screenshots of CRITR that just kind of show in the upper left the overall startup interface, and then a couple of the other screenshots that show just examples of how we maintain some of the data in it. We've got a multi-tab form where we maintain the site data, and each tab represents a different category of data, such as corrective action management plan, you know, library documents, our partnering team meeting minutes, et cetera, for each site. Next slide. And, of course, another basic building block for our electronic data is our geographic information system. We need to be able to visualize and spatially represent all of our data. We have basic layers that we've constructed with our solid waste management unit boundaries, our plume boundaries, our sampling locations, and pretty much any of our other database information can be linked into and visualized through the GIS. And I think that in the future, the GIS is something that we're going to be continuing to build on and continuing to create custom automation for. So next slide, kind of wrapping everything up and tying it together, how do we use these tools to kind of overcome those previous management challenges that I discussed? Well, for mission requirements and reuse, I think it's kind of a no-brainer that communication is a key to making sure that we don't run into disconnects between our cleanup requirements and mission requirements. And the GIS has really helped us to visualize some of our constraints and environmental concerns for the planning personnel so that they can then take those concerns into consideration when they're locating new launch missions or industrial activities. Our Land Use Control Management Plan, one of our programmatic documents, also helps clearly identify responsibilities and outline our land use controls program and how those controls work. So hopefully some of these tools, we think, have helped us move from kind of hindering the siting process on the back end, that is being the dark cloud that comes in and rains on everyone's parade at the end of the siting process, where now we're actually working proactively up front to help them site new launch programs. Process inconsistencies, pretty much all of the tools that I talked about, the templates, the programmatic documents, and the various databases all kind of help us stamp out inconsistencies which might breed future problems. We really try to document everything so that we can ensure we have a clear reason for doing things the way that we do it and ensure that we're doing those things consistently. And I think that our statement of basis templates are a great example for how we've really beneficially ingrained consistency into one of our products. We had probably about a 2-year conflict about statements of basis back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. This was the first time we had completed any of these decision documents, and a lot of our stakeholders had a lot of different ideas about what the ideal statement of basis would consist of. And I mean, we spent 2 years where every single meeting was a painful reworking of each SB, and I mean, we were just wrapped around the axle, and it was a very big struggle. But we were finally able as a team to kind of take a step back, figure out what everyone's goals were, where we needed to go to meet them, and then we were able to develop a streamlined, relatively simple template for our SBs. And since then, I mean, we've managed to complete 30 or 40 of them, and really getting one done is no longer a big deal. We can pretty much get a statement of basis written in about a day, and when we bring it to the table and share it with all of our stakeholders, it's not a painful process anymore. And there's really no level of contentiousness or not. And I think, you know, looking back to where we came from, that's a huge success. Review and coordination on slide 44. You know, again, sometimes the lengthy reviews and difficulties with coordinating documents have caused slowdowns or a little bit of a derailment in our program. But certainly, the process of formal partnering goes a long way towards alleviating those issues because we communicate. We all communicate with one another. We have onboard reviews with our team. We sit down. We prioritize our schedule. We look at what documents or what projects are kind of looming on the horizon, and we figure out which ones are the most important, which ones are going to be bottlenecks, and, you know, we agree how we're going to address those things and how we're going to move them forward. Our programmatic documents provide our stakeholders with a decision framework, and then again, the templates that we've created ensure that they know what to expect when a particular type of document comes across their desk. Changing stakeholders and evolving regulatory process is always going to be a challenge, and we're never going to be able to eliminate this, but I think that we can minimize the impact of these changes through our documentation and information exchange process. Whenever we bring a new stakeholder on board, we provide them with a compendium of all of our programmatic documents, and then we review all of our decision tools with them. But we're not just, you know, kind of trying to foist a process that we've already developed and that's already set in stone off on them. We're also always looking for their feedback on what we can do to improve things. Are there new reports or new information categories or some routine updates that we can make that will help make their jobs easier and help them achieve some of their individual goals? Next slide. Conflicting program expectations and conflicting goals among our stakeholders can, of course, be a major source of strife. And again, we found that communication helps us to set realistic goals and team goals. Our partnering fundamentals encourage everyone to leave their hats at the door, and we always try to look at problems from one another's perspective. And I think that in the partnering environment, educating team members about one another's constraints and one another's processes has been extremely helpful and very productive. For example, I mean, our regulators are now pretty much up to speed on how the Air Force funding cycle works, and they know that it's not always a super flexible, you know, process, the funding process, but they also know that we will do everything we can to, you know, make changes along the way, and they're willing to work with us throughout the process within the constraints of that cycle. For example, in the last 2 years, we found some fairly high levels of PCB contamination in soil at a couple sites. Well, we sat down, we discussed it as a team, we determined that, I mean, the most critical thing was to immediately establish controls, erect warning signs, and, you know, to make sure that there wasn't an exposure potential. So we were able to go out and do that, you know, in the short term, and then at the same time, we were able to review our current budget and kind of reprioritize to try to fast-track and integrate new projects to remove those soils. Now, you know, they didn't have, our regulators didn't have any expectation, because they knew how things worked, that we were going to be able to do that overnight, but I think that they were pleasantly surprised that we were able to kind of re-wicker the program and do it quickly and responsively. Again, long-term planning is always something that we're looking at, because more and more of our sites are kind of winding down towards completion, or at least towards the long-term management phase, where we're maintaining land use controls, we're monitoring, and we're at some of the sites engaging in system operations. So we're always looking at how we can use our information management tools to ensure that these sites stay on schedule and meet intermediate as well as long-term milestones. We've recently completed both a 5-year review and a fairly extensive remedial program optimization, and we feel that both of these two processes have helped us kind of provide benchmarks for the future for when we're going to have to do other 5-year reviews and other RPOs. And also, both of those processes were very positive and helped us identify improvements to both our overall management framework as well as our site-specific plans. So next slide, one of our biggest challenges, remedy formalization and implementation. Obviously, implementing final remedies, major cleanups at sites is one of our major goals. We want to get out there and we want to actually clean up the contamination. That's what we're charged with doing here. Back again in the early 2000s, when we were first kind of getting our feet wet with these major multi-million dollar remediation projects, There were a lot of challenges and a lot of hurdles that we had to overcome in order to implement these large-scale actions. Some of this goes back to the statement of basis issues that I discussed earlier. Some of it comes from inconsistencies in past decisions. I mean, we did different things at different sites historically, and that was confusing to some of our new stakeholders, and it was a little bit hard to figure out how you move forward consistently when some of your past decisions were either inconsistent or might have appeared inconsistent because of the way that they were documented. And we also had some funding issues, which management helped us resolve at a Tier 2 level. Eventually, we were able to surmount all of those obstacles, clear the hurdles, and we were able to implement some very complicated cleanups on a very tight schedule. This included 3 innovative soil mixing remediation projects. We went through a succession of 3 sites implementing the same technology. We were able to apply lessons learned from one site to the next, and improve the process throughout. And these were actually triad-based remediation projects. We were able to dynamically tweak that remediation protocol based on real-time data throughout the treatment process. The technology involved using a large diameter auger to mix the soils. We then injected steam into the subsurface through ports on the auger, and that was injected over the soil column as the auger moved up and down. That steam volatilized our chlorinated solvent, dense non-aqueous phase liquid contamination, which we then extracted under a vacuum at the surface and treated. And then finally, after the auger had kind of finished working the hole with steam, on the last pass, we would inject zero-valent iron. It was a very complicated process, but we were able to collect that real-time data, and we were able to modify the process dynamically in the field as we moved from cell to cell and from site to site. Over the whole process, we were able to address deeper contamination than we had planned at a number of sites. We were able to add and delete some of those treatment cells dynamically as data from the nearby cells indicated that we didn't really have a lot of serious contamination. And we were also able to either increase or decrease treatment time at cells where the real-time data indicated that there was either less or more contamination than we had originally thought. And so we really feel that having the overall triad program construct helped us to make these individual triad projects a great success. The next slide, slide 47, just shows a couple photos of some of the equipment that we used during the soil mixing projects in order to collect that real-time data and then visualize it for the field personnel who were actually actively making the decisions. So finally, lessons learned. I mean, I can't say enough about communication among the stakeholders. I mean, communication and using that communication to help prioritize the work is just a key to project success. Having readily available information resources that are accessible to all of the stakeholders, I think, are part of what helps make that effective communication possible. And, you know, what helps build stakeholder confidence. Personally, it's my experience that having information resources maintained locally in a format that is both accessible and manipulatable by local staff is very important. I mean, you can have the greatest, most high-tech, snazzy database in the world, but, you know, if you need somebody with a PhD in astrophysics in order to, you know, extract your information from it or massage any of your data in it, it's really probably not going to be much of a day-to-day help. So we've really focused on, you know, documenting everything, organizing everything, but at the same time making sure that it's accessible and that it's understandable to all of our stakeholders. So, I mean, in conclusion, we think that process is very important. We think that consistency is very important. but only where they're beneficial. We're always looking for opportunities to innovate and to try to kind of marry that consistency with flexibility and innovation. So finally, my last slide, just got a couple photos of some of our successful remediation projects or remediation systems. We just really feel that, again, programmatic triad has been the key to project level success across the board as well as in the future. Thank you. So if anybody's got any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. I'm not actually online here, so, you know, Nick, if anyone submits anything through the website, hopefully you can translate.
Yes, no problem. And while everybody's thinking about asking a question, I do have a question about you talked about formal partnering on several accounts as being very critical. Can you explain if that formal partnering with the stakeholder groups, is that specifically documented? And if it is documented, to what level of detail is it? Does it include things like who will participate in what types of decisions? How would you describe the formal, when you say formal partnering?
Well, it's formal in that, like, the Air Force has basically formally bought into it, and the regulatory agencies have formally bought into it, you know, at a higher management level than mine. It's formal in that there are multiple tiers with, you know, myself working at the lower tier one kind of working level. We've also got tier two, which is my boss and his counterparts with the other stakeholders above him. There's tier three, which again is even a higher level. It's also formal in that we kind of have written rules of operation, which it's formally facilitated. We have a facilitator present at each meeting to kind of make sure we don't get derailed and off track. We also have, you know, like a formal visitor package, which we try to provide to folks when they're coming to present to our team so that they know what to expect from us. They know, you know, what format their advanced data packages should be in, the types of things that they should include in their presentations. And yes, that documentation does include, you know, a list of who our core team members are, who our adjunct members are, who our support team members are, what the roles of those individuals are, and basically who participates in formal decision making and what constitutes a formal decision. Does that answer your question?
Very well, thank you. If anybody else has any questions, now is the chance. Pound six to unmute your line. And if nothing comes in and nobody stops me, I'm going to direct you all to slide 51, which is the last slide, and a very big thank you to both John Soule from Columbia Technologies and Regina Dixon Butler from the U.S. Air Force for taking the time to deliver these very informative presentations. First, with regards to slide 51, links to additional resources. You can click on that interactively. There are more details. Download the presentation, links to the Triad Central website, as well as the opportunity to get more information on the Triad Community of Practice. And basically, these 7 days that were held on CLUIN, the Triad Community of Practice kind of supported EPA in coming up with this concept. And we'd like to encourage everybody to participate in this ongoing discussion that the COP has every other month. There's a link in there to contact Dina Crumling to get on the list, facilitated by Thomas Heim. And then the feedback form, very important for us to continue to improve the process here. So with that, I don't know, Gene, if I'm missing anything, I encourage you to jump in and close it out formally.
Thanks very much, Nick. I think you covered all the key things. We did have one or two questions that kind of came in online. They were real simple ones, asking Regina, is some of the templates you referenced were publicly available?
I don't know that they're really publicly available, but I would be happy if anyone would want to email me to provide, you know, copies of some of the documents that we routinely use as templates.
Okay, great. And again, for those of you who are participating today, you can get Regina's contact information from the seminar homepage, which is the same page you use to sign up and join today's event.
And so Jean, if I can just provide one corollary or additional piece of information to that, our electronic archive does contain documents which follow most of those templates. So I could also, you know, again, via email or what have you, provide links to some of the documents on that electronic document repository, you know, which are based on our templates.
Okay, great. And then it was related to that in terms of how much effort or perhaps, you know, what sort of manpower did you need to maintain all of these electronic systems? You did talk a lot about the need to keep that information up to date. Was there an individual or a whole staff person who dedicated towards maintaining those information repositories?
Well, it kind of differs on a day-to-day basis depending on what's most critical for us at the moment. But I've been here 11 years. I've pretty much spent most of that time developing a lot of these resources and doing the initial population with some of the historical data. Frankly, that was the most time-consuming portion. And, I mean, for my first few years here was pretty much, I mean, all I worked on. I basically had my head buried in a lot of dusty boxes of documents and correspondence and everything. Getting through that historical backlog, getting it all indexed, getting it all cross-referenced, I mean, figuring out in some cases even what it all meant and how to index and cross-reference it was a challenge. But once it's in there, all of that historical information provides, you know, a great resource and a great perspective on how we've done things historically and why we did them. And then maintaining the kind of daily influx of data is not quite as challenging. I mean, it does take time. We do have several staff members who help maintain various aspects of our data management system, but I wouldn't say that any of them, you know, are wholly engaged in that. That's certainly not all that they do. We total here have a staff of six people.
Okay.
And, you know, that includes maintaining these information resources as well as all of our day-to-day, you know, project and program management tasks.
Okay, great. Well, I still see any more questions coming in online. And as Dick mentioned, it was #6 to unmute your line. So one last call. Go ahead and speak up and interrupt me if you do have any questions for either of our presenters today or Nick, our moderator. Well, then with that, if there aren't any additional questions, again, the final reminder that all of our contact information is available from the seminar homepage that you can get to. You can always go to cluin.org and find my contact information and feel free to reach out to me either by phone or email and follow up with any other comments or questions you may have. As Nick mentioned on the final slide today, we do ask you to take a look at the additional resources page as well as take a minute to fill out that seminar feedback form. We do read each and every single one of those comments that come in and use that to help gauge our performance and make sure that we continue to deliver seminar series like this one today. I also want to echo my thanks and gratitude to not only today's speakers, but also the TRIAD community of practice for helping organize this entire 7-part seminar series, as well as all the participants who were able to actually attend with us not only today, but in the other deliveries earlier this month. Again, everything will be recorded and made available as part of the Cluin archive. We are working on the first 6 of the 7-part series now. I think we've got one up, and the rest will be following in the coming weeks. So be sure to stay tuned to the cluin.org/training page to take a look at not only our archive trainings, but also new trainings as they become available and posted on the Cluin website. So with that, I guess we're going to terminate the session about 30 minutes early. And thanks to everyone, and I hope you all enjoy your day, and I'll see you soon on another Cluin Internet Seminar.